Hello, and as always, a very warm welcome to another session of Ruda Talks Change on the Change Exchange, which always makes me fluff. I cannot say that, the Change Exchange. We have an absolutely lovely guest today, both in both senses of the word, Catherine Constantinides. Catherine, climate and social rights activist, the first Miss Earth South Africa in 2003 when she brought the organization here, businesswoman, a mother. And Catherine, we met sometime years ago. I can't remember what the circumstances were.
I'm not exactly sure what it was. I remember I was so honored to get the opportunity to meet with you because I think growing up, there are certain media personalities that are truly iconic, and you certainly are one of them. So I don't remember what the circumstances were. I just remember what it felt like meeting you. And so doing this interview with you today is truly, truly an honor.
No, thank you for making time, because you sound like a very, very busy person. You started the company that you still run, SA Fusion, at the age of 16. Why and what?
So from a very young age, I was doing quite a lot of community service. And the reason I was doing the community service was really because I grew up in a home where doing community work was what we did as a family. On a Saturday, I remember so often being very little, and my sister and I would go with my dad to play bingo at old age homes, or we would go into rural communities and assist to feed people or share a meal with them, be it at Christmas or Easter. So these were the things that we did, not because we tried to make time for them, but literally that was our way of life. And I honestly grew up thinking that that's how everybody lived and how everybody engaged in society. But as I got older, I realized that only a few people did what we were doing. In fact, not many. And at school, I tried to get as involved in any community societies and things like that at a school level. And that kind of grew. And because I was trying to now raise funds for some of the community projects my sister and I were doing after school, we decided that we had to do something to raise funds. And the first and easiest thing to do, or to try to do, was to do events. And we started to do events where we could raise funds to do some of the bigger projects we were ambitious enough to take on. But what landed up happening was that we started getting corporates who would ask us to do events for them. So firstly, from a very young age, I started to lie about my age unequivocally, because firstly, nobody believed that we were at school. And secondly, nobody would believe how old we were anyway. And so my philosophy has always been, if you're good enough, you're old enough. And we started doing events, and we went into brand work and started getting campaigns. But few ever knew that we were at school from 8 till about 3, and we were doing this work after hours, in the evenings, on weekends. But we eventually had to formalize it, hence starting a company at that age.
So you learned on the job. There was no training before.
No, we learned on the job. And I think, looking back, I often look back and think to myself, I think some of the greatest success has always been the fact that we were young enough to fall, to fail, to get up so quickly, and to learn from those mistakes, to learn from the success as well, and learn how to amplify that, how to get up. That saying, you fall 7 times, you get up 8. And that's really so true. And I think being so young, it wasn't an issue for us. It was something that I think as you get older, pride sometimes gets in the way. And I think people, if they're honest, pride does get in the way. And I think it's much harder to accept defeat or to realize you've done something in the wrong manner, etc. But being so young, you're so ambitious and you're so excited to find different ways to do something. So I think that has been part of our greatest success, learning on the job.
I think as you grow older, it's also fear. It's not only, I grant you that it's often pride, but it's also fear, because there's so much more to lose. When you're 16, 100%. I mean, what can you lose?
100%. Yes, very, very much so.
And you went to university to Wits, and it all went very well. And then you had severe family trauma, which we'll talk about later. Your father got sick. But in the process, you lost your funding and you couldn't continue your studies. How did you work with that? It was a change. We talk on this program, what we focus on is those change moments and how one responds to the change moment. Sometimes it is the changes come because you decide, but very often the changes are forced on you by circumstance, by life. And in this case, it was absolutely not your choice. How did you react?
So, you know, Rhoda, I think that was definitely when I kind of plot out my life, there are those moments that you often speak on, and many of the previous interviews you've had, you always kind of focus in on those moments that are fundamentally the change moments of your life. And losing my bursary at university was certainly one of them, because growing up as a young girl, the only thing I was ever going to do was law and politics. I was always going to become South Africa's president. And that was from as far back as I could remember, that was something that I held so dear to my heart and my life. And going to university on a bursary, applying for a bursary, accepting that, but being accepted, and then losing that bursary well into my second year, because I now apparently did not fit the criteria. I also have an issue with classifying myself as white. I fundamentally believe I'm South African, and so my documentations carried the same. And when I was now penalized for that because I was South African, but I was white, and even though I could not afford the university because, as you had mentioned, my father was very ill, you know, it didn't matter, because I now had to unfortunately sacrifice my education because I did not fit perfectly into a specific kind of box. And I was punished for something that was not my fault. It was a very difficult challenge to carry. And I think it took me years. I think I still carry a deep pain because I fundamentally believe that education is the cornerstone of everything, and building our communities, finding a way out of so many of the challenges we face as a global community as well. And so at that point, I had applied for 7 other bursaries, I must say, and all 7 were denied on the same principle. So it was something that I carried a very heavy weight on my shoulders for a long time. But I had to decide in that moment that I would work as hard as I could to ensure that my siblings would go through school and they could choose to go to university and they could choose to do anything they wanted. I never wanted them to feel the pain and the anger that I felt with my bursary being taken away. It was something that I've taken a long time to deal with. And, you know, sometimes you'll be in a room or on a platform and the first thing people want to ask you is, but what did you study? And it's really always been so hard for me to have to explain my journey. But I look back at my journey and I think to myself, had I finished that degree, had I gone through that process of the university path that I had always dreamt about or thought about so deeply, there are opportunities that I would not have had. And there are moments in my life to have done things in places that few ever go to that I don't think would have happened. I would have followed a very different path. Perhaps
you would you would have followed a much more conventional path, and one where you were probably then not challenged as much, and therefore, you know, it would have been, in a sense, much easier to stay in your box, stay in your defined box. But then your response was to, did you join World Peace, the World Peace Organization?
I had the opportunity to join the World Peace Organization based in Asia, and that opened up many opportunities for me to, and that came as a result of the community work I was quite invested in South Africa. And because of that, I had the opportunity to travel both to Japan, to stay in Cambodia for quite some time, and to look at ways of dealing with poverty and a lack of education in Cambodia, specifically for the children who beg on the border for a dollar a day. And that opportunity to live in the slums of Cambodia in a stilt house over water, to be able to engage with children who cannot speak the same language as you and probably have not seen anybody who looks like you, was truly, truly not only challenging, but so humbling and such a special, special opportunity. I wouldn't give it up for the world.
What an amazing experience, and it must have kind of opened up your head space immensely. You were what, 20?
Yeah, no, I was very young. I was 19 or 20, and I think the greatest success when I work on community projects, even to this day, I think it's that I've had such broad experience working in such remote places and had hands-on experience on the ground. And I was able to bring that experience back to South Africa. I was able to be more informed when we look at ways of doing projects, engaging with communities, because the challenges have always been, you know, there's always a challenge of a language, of culture, of geographical location being so vast, and I think that that's actually been my strength, and that's something that I've learned to harness as truly my superpower when I'm working on the ground.
Mm-hmm. So how long did you stay, and what brought you back? Was that when you came back with the Miss Earth idea?
So I had been working in and out of Cambodia for probably about a year or 2 years. And what had happened was I had, in the interim and in and amongst all of this, I had the opportunity also to travel to Texas and do some things in Texas. And all through this time, I was contacted by the international organizers of the Miss Earth, who are based in the Philippines. And they were running all of the programs and projects based from the Philippines, and they were running all the country initiatives, etc. It had just started out at that time, and so they had contacted me and asked me if I would come to represent South Africa, and if I would take on, you know, running as Miss Earth South Africa, being their ambassador for the following year. And during that time, I would have to go to the international event, which took place in the Philippines. That was then also the start of extensive work I would then continue to do in the Philippines in communities there. And what then happened was that after that experience, I really, really believed that I wanted to run something, but in South Africa. So not remotely being done from the head office, but I really wanted the opportunity to bring it back to South Africa, but to build an initiative that would be more of a leadership program for women, an opportunity to allow young women to give a year of environmental community service to their communities, but to educate them during that process on not only community work, but to educate them on the environment, a space that was very much predominantly male dominated. And unfortunately, so many years later, we still find that the environmental climate space is still dominated by men, but there are a lot more women who are very actively involved around the world now. But we set up our project to really be something that was more than just about what you look like and how you present yourself and all of these good things, but it really was something that would move into the future, understanding that climate change was real. And I think because of the environmental work that I was doing and the community work I was doing on the ground, I was able to already see the impact of climate change. Communities that I was working with who no longer had access to safe, clean drinking water, they had to start moving. People who were impacted because their crops were not growing how they used to. And now this is a long time ago, and to be able to have been so, you know, creating something that would allow us the opportunity to grow in a space where we believed fundamentally in how do we impact climate change and positively add value in that space. It has been a lifetime of intense work when nobody believed that environmental issues or climate change was even something that affected not only South Africa, but the Southern Hemisphere. This was a Western issue, and it was not something we should be focused on, but we were determined to make a difference and to lay a foundation.
And how has the path of the organization run in South Africa? You came back in 2003. and you set it up immediately. And so how did it grow?
So we would actively, you know, create awareness, get young women who wanted to be involved. We saw, you know, the journey we've walked through the Miss Earth program has been an unbelievable one, in the sense that when we started, there were very few young women who were actively involved in any kind of environmental work. And this was almost their first exposure within that space. And then within a few years, we would see young women who would come back to the program. You know, they weren't announced as an ambassador or a winner, and they'd re-enter and re-participate. And it was those young girls who specifically would re-enter that started to be more involved because of their newfound love for the environment. And, you know, there's one young woman who I always think about. She was studying something in the commerce space. She changed her entire degree to go and study environmental law. And at the time, there was very limited places where she could do environmental law. She didn't only go on to do environmental law in South Africa, but she went on to do her honors and her master's at a university abroad. She is now a professor of law and is at one of the universities in South Africa. And I always get goosebumps because every time she graduated, she'd send us photos from Germany or somewhere in the US or somewhere in Europe where she was, and she was graduating with yet another accolade to her degree. And she now is able to really, really have such a broad base of young minds that she constantly is exposing her passion for the environment to, her protection through the law. And there are many examples of young women like that who have gone on to do unbelievable things. And when you see them being interviewed or speaking on their career, and they say that it was that moment that through that program they were exposed to something that they didn't know about before, and they are now standing as lawyers or advocates or marine biologists, and they're doing great things. For me, then we've done something fantastic.
Yes, indeed. I wanted to go one step back, actually, and ask, many young South Africans find themselves in the position that you were in your second year, with not enough funding to continue for whatever reason. Advice?
The one thing that I did, I think you need to try and find a way to study. That for me, find any way, even if it's not exactly what you had hoped to study. If you can find a bursary doing something different, grab it and run with it, because at some point you'll be able to diversify. But get into that tertiary education space to start with. So that would be my first advice. Try and fight. I did, but every door closed. But that is not the case, and I think there are so many more opportunities from a bursary and funding perspective. Pursue them. Pursue them until you're all out of being able to have any other options. And then the other thing that I would share as advice, and something that I did and I still actively do, you need to be deliberate about this, though. And this is not just for somebody who loses their funding or cannot find funding, but the one thing I've always tried to do in my life is whenever you enter a room, whenever you have the opportunity to meet someone, it doesn't matter if you get to meet them for 5 minutes, 20 minutes, an hour, you know, several engagements with them. But when you walk into a room and you meet new people, what can you take away from them? What wisdom can you learn? And I've immersed myself in spaces where I can enrich myself with the knowledge of others, with the life lessons that they're able to share with me, because that for me has been my greatest education, not only being on the ground, but truly being deliberate about enriching myself through the wisdom of others and those that I surround myself with.
You once had the amazing fortune of having tea with Mr. Mandela. Tell us.
It was such a wonderful experience, and I will never forget it. It was a surprise. So throughout my primary school career, and as a school child, I would write letters to Madiba. And I would always ask my parents to send him these letters, and I was never sure that they did, but it seems that they did, because one day I came back from school and in the post box there was a white letter for me. My name was on it, but I will never forget, it had a turquoise stamp on the front and on the back, and the seal at the back said Desk of the President. And I opened it with such, glee because I actually got a letter in return. And so all my life, it was such a big thing. I always wanted to meet Madiba. I said that was one thing I always wanted to do. I grew up in a home where my family were very liberal and open-minded and shared with us politically what was going on in the country, even from when we were little and probably didn't understand. But we had a very open-minded home. And when I was going to be going to the International Miss Earth event in the Philippines, somebody told me they needed to pick me up. They needed to take me to a meeting. I needed to be ready at a certain time. And I'd gone with them. We had driven to a place. And only when I arrived at this place did I realize that I was going to be having tea with Madiba. I was completely beside myself. I must tell you, as I walked into his office, and Rita, I'm sure you'll remember his office, which sits now at the foundation. But as I walked in, his desk is on the left-hand side. But walking in, obviously, I had no idea where I was. You know, I walked in, and as I turned, I tripped over his foot. And I literally tripped right in front of him, and that was my introduction. And he kindly helped me up. And we sat on the couch in his office for a few hours. So that tea was tea on repeat, and it was the most wonderful experience. And what I didn't realize was that after that, I would have many opportunities and moments to share in his company and to be invited into spaces when he was hosting dignitaries or presidents and high-profile guests in South Africa. And so the time that I got in his company and in his midst is something I will always treasure, because from that young girl who always dreamed of meeting this president and would write letters of suggestions of what I thought he should be doing or not doing, it was really truly a privilege to have had the opportunity to meet him and to be in his company so many times thereafter.
And as you said earlier, you learn from every person you meet. The major lesson that you got from him, that you learned from him?
The one thing I remember asking him was if he could do his life over again, or if there was something that he could do differently, what would it be? And he said to me that his greatest regret is that he could not build more schools. And I sat there and I was more dumbfounded at the fact that he had something that he regretted, because here is a giant man to humanity, not just to us as South Africans, but to global citizens for generations to come. This man will always be one of those iconic humans that goes down in history. And I think that when I sat there and he actually had something that he had consciously thought of as at the end of his life, that this is something still that he did not manage to achieve, yet he did so much. I sat there and I thought to myself, who are we to live our lives and tick off things on our list of things that we want to do and think that that's enough? Because he has a man that gave so much to our country and so much to the world, and yet he still believes that he could have done more.
Mm-hmm. So always aim higher, always do Absolutely. The next thing.
And yeah. Always challenge yourself. Once you've reached or achieved something, make sure that you set the goalpost further, that you look for things that you think are impossible, but as he said, nothing is impossible until it's done. So I think that for me, that was a real life lesson there and then.
And it must have been absolutely wonderful when you were chosen as one of the recipients of the Archbishop Tutu Leadership Fellowship when was it, 2013? You went to Oxford, because that was usually given to graduates, and for you, for whom it's obviously still, it still hurts that you couldn't finish your degree. That must have been wonderful.
It was such an incredible moment, because for all the reasons that you have just said, I was not only the youngest fellow, but I was also the only fellow that did not have an undergrad. The people that were in my year and my class of fellows for that year were unbelievably accomplished people who are doing incredible things. Several of them were serving in ministerial positions or offices somewhere on the continent. And this was a group of unbelievable African young leaders. Many were in banks and in technological spaces and places doing incredible things on the continent. And I had the opportunity to spend the year being a fellow with them, learning from them, understanding from them. And when you sit in such esteemed company and they turn around and they want to ask you questions, it truly, truly is an honor. And it makes you really reflect on the life you've lived. And I think that for me, it's always an important lesson to acknowledge where you have come from and the pains you've had to struggle with and the challenges, but to also acknowledge always the positives that come out of it. Because sometimes we get lost in the challenge and we forget to really realize and acknowledge the privilege that comes with the journey we still walk.
Catherine, your parents must be really special people, because to have given you the self-confidence to actually step up in that kind of situation is very special. Were you aware of that? I mean, young people, why were you not falling over yourself with shyness?
Sure. I must tell you, I would consider myself, even right now, I would consider myself a complete introvert, but I'm really good at engaging and being outward focused because of the work that I do. But if you have to meet my sister, you will be able to tell that I'm the complete introvert and she's the complete extrovert. I think that we grew up in a home where our parents, despite the fact that we never had a lot. We grew up in a very humble home where there were things that we grew up never having. I never knew that we didn't have. I never knew that we couldn't afford certain things, because we were so happy with the life we had. We'd spend time in our garden with my father, and he'd teach us about every shrub, flower, grass, tree, and he made us feel like we had an immense responsibility to look after not only that garden, but the earth. He made us feel like we were the warriors that the world waited for. And I think they instilled so much love in us that we never knew that we were missing anything, or that we didn't lack for anything. But they also taught us not only to dream big, but that we could achieve anything that we truly put our minds to. And I think growing up in a home where there's such nurturing love and care, I would certainly say that, you know, my parents were certainly larger than life. My father was a giant, and a giant in the sense that, yes, he was a big man, but just the way that he was, the way that he taught us that his life was one of service to others, through the way he made people laugh, the way he made people feel. When I lost my father 6 years ago, so many people, his funeral was something that I will never forget, because I didn't even know that so many people knew him. But we would constantly be told stories of people we had never, ever seen, but people that my father had done something for once in their life. And when they heard of his passing, they came to pay their respects. And we'd hear of stories of unbelievable things that my father did that we were never aware of. And I think that he lived his life making people happy, giving people a sense of worth and value and integrity. And I think that for me, that's why I say he really, really was a giant of a human being. And I think if I can just live a life where I just do a small portion of what he did in his life, I would really, really be happy. And in that way, I can honor my parents.
But I think the first thing he gave you, and I think as a mother also, the most important thing one gives one's children is the belief that they are, that they can, that they are okay, that they can step up, that they have possibilities and they can grab it. But we'll talk more about that in a moment. The next big thing that happened was the Mandela Washington Fellowship in 2016. How did you experience that? The Young African Leadership Initiative. I mean, it's a much wider group then, huh?
It was a much wider group, and the experience was a lot more intense in a shorter space of time. And I had the opportunity to meet Barack Obama and to really just have a very different experience. That was a remarkable experience, I must tell you. When the program first started, I think maybe 3 or 4 years prior to that, at that time, every single day, because of of the way I would travel every single day. I drive past the American consulate in northern Johannesburg, and outside that consulate there is a huge, huge flag. And I would look at that flag and I would deliberately just manifest and think about the fact that that fellowship was something really, really extraordinary and something that one day I would hope to be a part of. And when they phoned me and told me that I had been shortlisted and they'd like me to come for an interview, I was...
Did you have to apply?
That was an application process, yes. And so the other one is almost is a nomination process. This one is an application process. But the challenge is that there are approximately, I think, 15 or 16,000 applicants, and they are then shortlisted by countries and then down to, you know, from a continental perspective, and then they choose a group from each country to fit into three specific spaces, public service, social development, and business. And so I think that for me, when they let me know that I had made it through, I was immensely, immensely humbled for that opportunity. I had no idea what would be awaiting me on the other side. But for this, you spend between 6 to 10 weeks in the U.S., and you are appointed to a university. You're appointed with a group of fellows. I was in a group of 22 other fellows, 21 of them from countries all across the continent. So I was the only South African in my group. Some of the groups had two or three South Africans, but I was the only South African in my group. And I got to spend time with people from 22 nations across the continent that I would never, that we lived with. We lived, we ate, we did everything together for 6 solid weeks before we went to Washington, D.C. together. And it was such an enriching experience. I had to learn where Eritrea and Somalia were and exactly what the conflict there has been and exactly how, you know, the different cultural differences between different people who were coming from different places. It was such an enriching experience because you lived in a house together, traveled together, and spent every waking moment. And so when you knocked heads or when we were conflicted by ideologies that we were sharing or things that we were learning about, it was such an enriched space because you had to find a way through the conflict because you had to live together and you had to get up the next morning and still face each other. So I think that you just learned leadership skills on a very different level, but it was an experience that was truly extraordinary. And I'm so, so grateful that I had that chance and that opportunity.
You now describe yourself on your website as an activist. When did you decide that this is what I am? This is my definition of myself.
It's a very difficult question that you're asking me because I think that, you know, when I was interviewed many, many years ago, and somebody interviewed me and kept referring to me as a social entrepreneur. And I thought to myself, my goodness, I didn't even know what this term social entrepreneur was. And once I understood it, I thought it was a perfect fit because the work that I was doing was always to achieve a certain goal and to focus in on a certain community or social injustice that I was exposed to that I wanted to try to change or adapt the community to, etc. And then probably about 8.5 years ago, out of nowhere, I was invited to speak at a conference. The conference was to be hosted in a place called Dakhla, which is in North Africa. And the invitation came from the King of Morocco's office. And I think that at that time, I had to search firstly where Dakhla was. I knew where Morocco was, but it was definitely not a place that I was interested to go to or, you know, attend the conference or speak at the conference, etc. But to cut a very long story short, I'd need to write a book just on that specific experience. But I never landed up going to that conference. Instead, I landed up going to a refugee camp in North Africa where the people of Western Sahara live. And after I spent some time in these Sahrawi refugee camps, which are in southwest Algeria, because Western Sahara is illegally occupied by Morocco, as I left on a military plane. So you walk up the back of the plane and you get onto this plane. And as I sat on this very, very cold and noisy plane, it's just like metal inside. It's not like an actual commercial airline. And as I sat there, I realized to myself that I don't know how on earth these people came to me or that I found them, but I knew that my life would never be the same because I had found a second nation. And so for the last 8 years, my work on Western Sahara from a humanitarian perspective and using my platforms to be a voice for the voiceless, they are certainly the forgotten people of Africa. And for whatever reason it might be, and maybe one day God will reveal to me exactly what the reason was, but I have dedicated my time, my effort, my resources to do all that I can in my capacity as an individual to bring to the fore the injustice of the Sahrawi people. And so I call myself an activist because as an activist, I'm given the opportunity of places and spaces that even they as refugees or stateless people are not able to access. So as an activist, I have international platforms that I'm privy to and can work alongside the Sahrawi people to really give them a voice and a platform.
How do you balance the two parts of your life? On the one hand, you still have to run your company in order to get the money to do the work that you want to do. How does one do that in practice? Is your sister, who is your partner, does she help? How do you work it?
So for the last few years, Ella has been she's been the backbone, the spearhead, everything. She really has. She's run the organization, and over the last, more particularly the last 5 years, excluding COVID, because I was grounded in all sense of the word. We couldn't leave the country. We couldn't move. But for those years prior to that, Ella really, really, she steered the ship, she ran the organization, and she allowed me the freedom to do the humanitarian work I was doing. So I had the privilege to work in many parts of the world. I even went to Kashmir, Pakistan. I worked in parts of Rwanda, Ethiopia, Cote d'Ivoire, Togo, and many other places. But only because she allowed me that freedom and space to be able to do the humanitarian work I was doing. My work then on Western Sahara has been able to fit perfectly into that space. Outside of coming out of COVID, hopefully there will be more spaces where we can be more actively engaged. But it has been a challenge and it has been a balancing act. But I've got to say that I personally believe that there's no such thing as perfect balance. Something will always have to give. Some days you will wake up and you will have to decide that today work is going to have to give because my little boy has got a concert and I'm not missing that concert for anything. And then there is a Saturday or a Sunday where, unfortunately, your family is going to have to give because there are certain work commitments or certain community commitments that you cannot change or, you know, pull yourself from. So it's a difficult thing, but I'm a firm believer that you have to be deliberate about the decision you make on what's going to give and what you prioritize, how and when. So the balancing act is more about your deliberate choice of defining what's important and what's urgent.
Yeah, but it's also what I'm also hearing and what I know from personal experience is the team. You cannot do this alone.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I am so blessed to work with people that have your back. To work with people that understand what your vision is, and you are 100%, you know, people might see me at the forefront, or they might hear me doing an interview or championing a cause, but I don't do that alone. I don't do that without the backing and support of a team. Ella has been the most remarkable human being. God gave her to me to really allow and assist me to do the work that I do. And so much of it I've had the privilege to do with her. But I also come from a family and a home that have held my family foundation so strong that I'm able to do what I do. And absolutely no person can do what they do. You may see them as an individual on their own, but you can be rest assured that they come with an army of people behind them who assist and support them to do what they're doing.
I knew that this interview, this conversation was going to be long, but I still want to talk to you about the a little bit more personal. You brought your family into the discussion, and I know I've gathered how important they were for you, are to you. You were also married for 2.5 years, and it sounds as if in the beginning it was really, really good. How does one handle it when it goes wrong? Once again, what is your advice? Because it happens. It happens to all of us.
I mean, you never get married with the thought that you could possibly ever get divorced. Not even something that crosses your mind. But unfortunately, what was my reality and unfortunately my experience was that I did get married, and unfortunately from literally the day after I got married, I realized that this person that I had known for almost 7 years, I didn't know at all. They became completely this complete stranger. And so it unfortunately was a very horrific experience. I can tell you unequivocally that I know what the inside of hell looks like, because the way that it all unfolded and how everything happened, eventually I realized that if this didn't come to an end, eventually this person has the ability to kill me and to find a way to get away with it. And I think that unfortunately, I myself was so scared to speak about what was going on behind closed doors, and I was so scared for many reasons. But I also learned that you can never ever judge somebody because you don't understand the circumstances that take place behind closed doors. So, you know, being somebody who was now pregnant and then, you know, had a little days old baby and was now going to be going through a divorce was something I was so scared of how the world would judge me. And I look back now and I think it didn't matter how the world was going to judge me or not. My priority had to be that baby, which it was. And that little baby, I did not know at the time, but he would become the center of my universe and my complete light source. And I'm so grateful again that I have a family who have helped me to get through the darkest days of my entire life. And I have a young child who is such a vibrant soul, and he is allowed to be the person that he is. And I know that he wouldn't be that person had I stayed married. And some people choose to stay in a relationship for the sake of a child. And I think in my own experience, I could never have done that, because my child would not be the same person that he is today. And
was there abuse, Catherine?
It was a very abusive relationship. It was a very, I would, every day that I would drive home, like literally every day, I'd cry all the way home because I was so scared. If I said something that angered him, if I did something that angered him, my cell phone wasn't allowed to be on. My car keys needed to be accessible, and there were many, many weekends where he would take my car keys and he wouldn't give them to me because he didn't give me permission to go anywhere. I'd literally, my entire life had come to a halt because this was not, I didn't grow up in a home that was like that. I didn't know if this was normal. I was too scared to tell anybody what was going on.
Even your parents, even your sister.
In the beginning, I was too scared to tell anyone. I think I was really embarrassed and I was ashamed of what was happening. And to a large extent, I was ashamed because here is somebody who is very strong in who they are. I can tell you that I can dream up anything and I can believe that I can achieve it. And now I look in a mirror and I didn't know who was looking back at me. And I was ashamed of that. I was ashamed that I had allowed myself to get into a space where somebody would destroy me to my core, and somebody would be able to control me in such a manner. And to a large extent, I did that. I allowed that to happen. Mm-hmm. And so I was very scared to tell anybody because it was, I couldn't work out how I so quickly could get to that point.
So humiliating. So what?
Absolutely.
How did you finally make that decision and then manage to do it? Because I mean, women in that situation, it is so difficult to get out, both emotionally and practically.
Absolutely. So financially, I was not at all reliant on him. Oh. And I think that was one thing that was a big plus in my corner. It's not always the situation, and that is a big, big challenge for many women and many people in relationships. But I'm grateful that that was not something that I was worried about. I also had a family that I knew no matter what had happened, they would help me or they would look after me. But the breaking point was that I was in a place where he was getting angry at me for everything and anything because he couldn't, he was scared that he couldn't control me. And I think that, I couldn't change. I didn't automatically become somebody else. So the person he married was the person that I had hoped he would love. But it didn't work out that way. And because I was now not becoming what he probably in his mind imagined I would be, eventually the things that were going on behind closed doors were too horrific. And eventually I had to, on one day when he chucked me out because I had done something without asking for his permission first, for me, that moment, I'd never in my life ever cried that much as I did in that moment. And I asked my mom to come and pick me up, and literally she picked me up from a pavement where he had thrown me to. And I think about that.
With the baby? With the baby? What about your son?
Yep, with my baby. But Rita, it's a horrific thing because you try and try and try. And I think it's perhaps that motherly instinct where you do everything and you try and prove yourself and you try and do everything to make it work. And after that, I went back. And I went back because I wanted to find a way to make it work and to make things find a way to make it happen. But the truth is I couldn't. And so when eventually then I just never went, there was a day that I went to work and I never came back. But he would then not let me take any of my baby's things. I lost everything. I lost my home that I had financially paid for. I lost my baby's everything that was material, but I had my child. And being an attorney, he put me through absolute hell. And it was a very horrific divorce process. He had threatened to have the baby taken, and he never, ever once, never to this day, never once contacted me to ask how the baby was or the child was, not once. And I look back on what was the darkest, darkest experience of my life, and I think to myself that I'm so grateful that it worked out the way it did. At the time, you don't see that, and you cannot accept it. But I look back and I think to myself, God made it work exactly how it was supposed to. I have an incredible young man. My child is becoming a young man, and he is such a solid human being. He's so happy, so confident. He has male figures in his life who he adores, and he's quite confident in the fact that he doesn't have a father. And when I got divorced, the divorce process took a long time, and eventually the only reason that he would go through with the divorce was because he tried to hit my mom, and I had laid charges against him. But he, in order to get the divorce to go through, I'd have to remove the charges, which I then did. And in the divorce, he wanted that I would specifically state that I would never make contact with him for any medical or school expenses for the child, and that he would, he didn't want to be responsible for anything. And my lawyer said, this is not going to go through. These are against the human rights of the child, because every child has the right to parental
support of his parents. Yeah,
absolutely. And all of these things. And I must tell you, we went to court. It went through to the High Court in Pretoria, and I was the only person that arrived on that day. And the judge asked me all sorts of questions, and eventually said, no, that's fine. He's going to grant this divorce as it is. And I knew at that point I would be a mother, a father, a breadwinner, and everything else that my child would need. But I would ensure that my child has a happy home, a healthy environment, and that I do everything I can to give him the space to be the best that human being that he can be. And I was given that privilege as a child, and I was given the space to believe in who I am as a human being, and that I have a space in this world. And I have a young man and a child that is truly the light of my life, and possesses the most remarkable qualities, and I see so much of my father in him. There's nothing I could be prouder of.
Well done is all I can say, because to find the wherewithal in yourself after having been ground down like that, not many people, well, many people do not manage to do that and are ground down forever. So, yeah. No, congratulations. And it's wonderful. It sounds to me as if your first family was actually what made the difference. And it is the goodness and the support that your parents gave you that gave you the structure to enable you to give it now, as you say, to your son. So we're out of time, I'm afraid. So I'm going to say goodbye and thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you for being so open. I hope you don't regret it. No. Because sometimes one goes further than you might have wanted to. But no, thank you. All of the very, very best in all your endeavors.
Thank you so much. Thank you, and thank you for the opportunity to chat to you.
And thank you for the people out there listening and watching, and for the women. If you are in a similar situation, maybe you have heard of a possibility, it is possible. Do not stay there. All of the very best. Goodbye.